My name is Malavika Prasad, and I'm the host of Your Favorite Book, a podcast all about asking that big question, what's your favorite book and why? I have no real qualifications, I just love books, and more than anything, I love talking to writers and readers about the books that have inspired them and made them the person that they are today. And today I'm talking to Madhushree Ghosh, the author of new memoir, Kabar, An Immigrant Journey of Food, Memory, and Family. And this is a memoir unlike any other that I've ever read. It combines genres, narrative forms, topics, and it really comes together in a cohesive whole that touches on so many different things beyond what that subtitle even tells us. And today we're talking about Azadi, which is a nonfiction collection of essays by Arundhati Roy. And this is some heavy topics, everybody. This is a heavy subject matter that we go into in this episode. But honestly, it's a long one, and I think you're really, really going to enjoy it. And plus, there's some food recommendations in this one, too, so don't want to miss that. So let's dive in, and welcome to Your Favorite Book. Okay, everyone. So Madhushree, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Thank you so much. It's an honor.
Now, the first thing I need to do is I need to start out by thanking you for the beautiful packaging that came along with your book. So when I got your book in the mail, it came with this little sachet of tea and this recipe for the dreaming of goat curry that you reference in the book. And it was really, really nice. And I have to tell you, A, I'm a vegetarian, and B, I don't drink tea.
Okay, so you got free stuff that you can give to somebody else. How about that?
Absolutely. I gave the tea to my sister and the goat curry recipe to my father. And so they're definitely going to love it. But I just thought that was funny. And honestly, since you reference, you know, drinking tea and vegetarianism so much in your book, I felt called out, but not in a bad way.
Yeah, I think I have friends who love going to goat yoga, and I keep telling them, if I went with you, there will be curry. And they're, you know, mortified when I say things like that. But I'm like, you got to try it and then you'll know, right?
I mean, I have all sorts of problems with the idea of goat yoga, and that's just one of them. Like,
I don't understand the concept. I mean, do you really like, you know, goat poop pellets falling on you while you're on Shavasana? I'm not sure.
Definitely not. But obviously, we have a lot to cover today. So we're going to be talking about your upcoming book. We're going to be talking about the book you chose for the show, which is Azadi by Arundhati Roy, which I'm really excited to discuss. But before we get to all of that, I'd love to know, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your work?
Absolutely. So my name is Madhushree Ghosh. I am the daughter of refugees. And by that, I mean my parents were babies when India got divided into what's now, so British India got divided into what's now India and Pakistan. And they were in the area, what is now Bangladesh, but in those days was called East Bengal. And so the division happened on the basis of religion. Us being Hindus, religious strife was significant at that time. And so they walked, took the train, took buses, and came to in India. And so I always refer to that, and people automatically assume that I was part of that largest human migration of the 20th century. I wasn't. It was my parents. So I'm the daughter of refugees, and I'm an immigrant to America. I came here for grad school in a PhD in biochemistry, and then a postdoc in molecular biology. So I was pretty much a science nerd, alongside my parents, my mother's side of the family being a family of journalists. So both sides of my brain has been working. They've been working pretty well, I think. So been writing fiction and nonfiction for quite a few years. My book, Kabar, An Immigrant Journey of Food, Memory, and Family, is out April. And that is a culmination of 20 years of a food narrative, food journey, and an immigrant journey that I'm so excited to talk to you about.
So the first thing I want to point out to you is you and I have quite a bit in common just from that initial introduction. I too sort of sit between the camp between science and writing.
So by profession, I'm a cancer genetic counselor. And so I really enjoyed seeing the little bits of your lab work in the book. As soon as you brought up polymerase chain reaction, I was like, oh yes, a fellow nerd. I'm all for this. I often find that science and writing just go really well together. And I like getting to exercise those curiosities and then turn to my writing and feel fulfilled in a completely different way. And obviously the two intersect as well, but it's just nice to have your foot in both camps and to explore both of those spheres.
Yeah. So I get that question quite a bit about how is it that both sides of your brain is working. And given that I'm not religious, I'm not going to say, you know, some godly things happen to us, but I'm going to say the universe gave us a full brain.
Yep.
Give us a left side and a right side. The universe didn't say you can only use one side. We decided that that's all we can use, right? So right. I just spoke to a few sixth graders, and I was telling them this, that, you know, you may not be excellent in math, but if you're above average in math, it's still worth pursuing. It's the same thing as writing. If you're just above average, it's basically a question of, I think I was just about an above average person in creative writing. And it was primarily 2 to 3 decades of ass in chair, keep writing till you get it to as best as you can. So I think both sides of our brain works. Having a scientific analytical brain helps you edit much better, I think. I have not had any angst over killing my darlings. I'm fine with it because I know this is how this fits in. So I'm hoping that when we use both sides of our brain, it's not considered to be abnormal, but the norm in the next few years.
Right. You're exactly right. And it really just does help in a lot of different ways. You're right. You turn on that analytical side when you need to, but then you have the creative side to just let you tap into some of that joy. And I really like that these days people are being encouraged to pursue both when they can. And bringing this back to your book, so your book, it's hard to characterize, you know, like we're talking about, it doesn't sit firmly in one specific genre. Like some people just kind of broadly describe it as a food memoir, but that doesn't encapsulate everything that you're doing. I feel like if I was to describe your book, it reiterates the fact that food is both personal and political, and you can't separate it from those things. And it's very similar to how Roy talks about fiction, but we'll get to that in a bit. But I guess I'm wondering from you, you know, how do you see the concept of genre? Is that limiting for your work? Is it something you choose to defy?
Yeah, no, I think you said it exactly as I intended it to be. Food was used as a medium to talk about social justice and politics. And words are politics, food is politics. And when you combine both of them, as it comes to immigration, as it comes to indenture, as it comes to migration, you need something that guides you. You need something that guides you, not only in terms of what is important to you, and that importance may be recipes coming down generations that you're continuing, or the fact that the same recipes were used as a tool of imperialism or colonialism. And food in itself starts conversations. Food in itself starts wars. Food in itself starts love. It is a very political tool, and that's what I wanted to use. Is it difficult to characterize? I think what people need to stop doing, and this is a very Western concept of continuing to say that, you know, you cannot have a memoir if it is braided with political stories of chefs and foods and cuisines. You cannot call it a memoir if it is just linked essays that are not really very closely linked. I think we as people are three-dimensional. We have many different interests in life. And, you know, I'll unabashedly say this. I'm a science person. I love logic, but I truly enjoy Bollywood. So, you know, take it for all you will, but that's where it's at. And Bollywood has no logic, has absolutely no logic. It's got lovely, beautiful women in awesome outfits and beautiful songs, but that's about it. I shouldn't say that's about it, but you know what I mean. So, that's my take on this is, why do we always try to characterize something into a neat little package of this is a food memoir, and therefore there should only be recipes and nobody should talk about the politics behind the food? Mm-hmm. If it is a memoir that talks about domestic partner violence, then Madhushree Ghosh must be a very, very angsty, sad, angry, passionate person, and she should not have a sense of humor. That is also not true. So, right. I'm trying to rattle the cages here. I'm trying to make folks understand that we are three-dimensional people, us immigrants. We are grateful, and then we are also passionate about where we come from. So we love both countries, and this is a product of that.
You're absolutely dead on. And I think a lot of it has to do with marketing, or like you said, it's a Western concept that things have to fall into these neat little boxes and you can't really go beyond that. But I feel like your book really stands out because you integrate pure nonfiction. You integrate the political, you integrate your personal stories, you integrate your life, and food is part of your life. And I think this leads in nicely to the other thing I really liked about your book is it's so specific. Not only did you fall into the idea of food memoir and stick to that, you didn't fall into the sort of the blanket Indian food memoir. You're proudly Bengali. Your food traditions are Bengali. Like those are the, you write often the, I eat fish on weekdays and meat on the weekends. And you talk about going to the markets with your father. And I'm like, that is a very specific culture within India, and India contains multitudes. For my listeners who are not Indian, I mean, Arundhati Roy says this in her book, imagine a whole country of Europe, the whole continent of Europe trying to be distilled into a country.
And here is pretty valid in terms of, you know, why did I focus on Bengali cuisine? Number one, I am Bengali, so that just kind of makes sense. But given the fact that, you know, I get on my high horse about what this book is about, it is about Indians who are not only the Punjabis, not only the South Indians, not only the folks who make the most noise outside of India that talk about, you know, a $9.99 buffet, all you can eat Indian buffet. I'm talking about Bengalis because that's where I come from. It is a political statement for me when I talk about this. But also what I want to do is make people understand how that food has morphed over the years and, you know, through different continents. And while I'm talking about Bengali food or how my mother used to cook, it really is a love letter to my parents. And they were very traditional Bengalis. They may not have been very traditional in the way they brought me up, but they were very traditional in the kind of foods they ate. And I wanted to pay homage to that. And also that gives you an overview of a childhood that was filled with love, but nobody said, I love you like they do in the West so often. Nobody said that in my family. We were not hugged like people are hugged, which is not to say that I'm not a hugger. I'm an extreme hugger, and that's a problem in the pandemic. But but I think their hugs were through food. And that's what I hope this book has accomplished, that, you know, some of us did have amazing childhoods. Right. And that childhood is what informs how I look at food now.
That's a really great way of putting it. And I just have to throw out there, especially since we're talking about Arundhati Roy as we go, you being Bengali, my family is from Kerala, and we're kind of representing both her heritages today.
Yes, we are. How cool is that?
Yeah, and you're exactly right with talking about, you know, your specific food culture may not be as loudly represented. I feel the same way. I mean, Kerala food is not broadly seen on your average Indian menu. I mean, it's always something special when I see it, but it's very much a subculture compared to sort of the broader Western concept of India. So it's really nice to see people embracing what is specific to them rather than trying to cater to a broad audience and broader expectations. So I really loved that about your book. And The last thing I wanted to ask you about your book specifically is the construction of your essays themselves. And you, like we talked about, you combine a variety of different genres and you layer the topics. So you will have an extended talk about when you were a child eating food at a cousin's house. And then you will switch time and talk about your relationship with your ex-husband, and you'll switch time there, or you'll talk about a paratha stall in Singapore and switch to a completely different topic within the same essay. Mm-hmm. And so I guess my question is, walk me through some of the compositional thoughts there. Were those separate ideas that you had? How did you bring all those together in a single piece?
No, that's a great question. I think it's about how your brain works. This is where, you know, a scientist's brain works maybe a little different from a non-scientist's brain. But I love the concept. I think, let me take a step back. I think humans think about 5, 10, 20 different threads of ideas when they're sitting by themselves. We are able to compute multiple threads, and they're all leading to something which we may not know while we are working on it. And so for me to use the medium of a braided essay, which is what all these essays are, was perfect to actually come to the final end point. So when I'm talking about a Singaporean paratha, I'm really not talking about the paratha per se. I'm talking about the concept of a chef, a food stall cook, and their competition, who's much younger. And so the whole idea there was, when I was reading up on that idea, was what happened with me in my life when I was trying to impress my now ex-in-laws and trying to cook what I thought was an example of my love for them and for their son and my now ex. And I didn't realize at that time that it was taken as competition. I did not realize that what I was making would be used to show that my now ex-mother-in-law wanted to show that she was a better cook. Now, was it a big deal? Maybe not. Was it a big deal for me? Absolutely. It's the reason why I wrote about it. But I like to bring this up primarily because, you know, in Indian cultures, in not just Indian, South Asian cultures, older cultures, there is a concept of the older women knowing more in the kitchen. And there is a concept of older women hiding recipes or one key ingredient in recipes just so it passes down the generation in a different way, but not to the daughter-in-law. There are many ramifications of this. And I just wanted to talk about that because when you're coming into another culture, my 17-year relationship and 10-year marriage was into a Tamil family, a South Indian family. I come from a Bengali family where we are very different in how we look at food, how we look at people, how we look at women, how we look at education. It's very different from the family I went into. And so trying to stick to the stereotypical roles of daughter-in-law eventually did not work for me. But it was also something that I wanted to address, that when you come into a new place, all you're trying to do is conform. All you're trying to do is hold on to something because you want to be part of that. And when you're talking about marriages like that, I also say you can extend that beyond into, you know, how we immigrants come to this country and we morph ourselves because we want to fit in so badly. We want to be so grateful for being given the chance to be part of this experience.
You said so much there. I feel like every single one of those topics could be its own episode, but you are totally right. You know, there is a natural layering that brings itself. I mean, how one topic bleeds into another. I mean, it's how the human mind works. We jump from topic to topic. We find connections within ourselves. It's how we think about it. And I love the parallel between, you know, entering a marriage to entering a new country, because it's exactly right. You know, you want to hold on to aspects of yourself, but at the same time, you are joining lives with this other, you know, something that is separate from you. And no matter how much you may love or get to know that other, they are separate from you. They have a completely separate context. And there's always going to be something hindering that, definitely in some cases more severely than others, but that's a very natural and very fitting metaphor there. And the last question I wanted to ask you, this is kind of a fun one. We've been talking about food. We've been talking about food that's specific to us. If you could recommend to my broader listening audience one Bengali dish that you think people should try, what would that be?
Are we looking at dessert? Are we looking at food?
Anything you want.
Okay, then we're talking
dessert.
Pick,
how about you pick a dessert and a food? Make it easy.
Okay. I think in the book I've talked about Nadu. Nadu is a very simple way. It's totally comfort food for me. It's totally comfort food for me because my mother used to make that and we would have that with tea. That was our thing. And the way I look at it is it's a coconut-based dish. You slow roast the coconut, you add in cardamom, and then you add in molasses or jaggery or sugar. Usually you add jaggery, at least that's what we did in my family. And then as it's cooling down, you make them into small balls. And what we used to do is just stick it between our teeth and drink hot tea so that would melt in. And so it's coconut and jaggery and all the goodness of it, you know, melting in your mouth. So what I did was I took the same, but I converted that into... Well, I westernized it. I usually Indianize Western food, but I westernized Nadu into, you know, you can add in, instead of using molasses, you can use agave or sugar, but add in chocolate. And so now you have, it's almost like a chocolate truffle, but it still has the Indian flavor if you add in a dash of cardamom. It's amazing to eat. It's very quick to make. The recipe's in the book if you want, or call me and I'll walk you through it. that's one. In terms of food, I always talk about fish because for me, fish curry is really that is my love story with my parents, and it's my love story with food. When you come to this country, you really don't know whether this fish came from a river or it came from the ocean. Yeah. And it was very important growing up that we knew that. My father would tell me what it was. And, you know, when you're growing up and your father says something, you just believe it. You don't even know what it means, but that's what it is. And, you know, usually he was right. And so that's been my habit of, you know, when I go to the fish market, I will actually choose the fish based on what he taught me, as in, you can figure out the freshness of the fish from the dryness of the scales. You can figure out how long this fish has been sitting on ice based on their eyes. And I'm sorry, Malvika, I know you're vegetarian, but...
I do eat fish. I'll tell you, I do eat fish. Okay. I just don't eat things apart from fish.
Okay. Then we're good. So the point here in the Western world is we have sanitized the concept of what we eat so much that we don't even know where it comes from. In a fish died for me. So if a fish died for me, I need to give it the respect by eating every part of it. That's the concept of fish in our family, in our Bengali world. So you'll eat the fish, you'll scale the fish, you will, you know, cut it, gut it, whichever way you want to prepare it. But a very simple way of doing it is you know, there's a spice called pachpuron or five spices. You can get them in any Indian store, or you can make it. It's you know, cumin, coriander, mustard, fenugreek, and fennel, and you know, one tablespoon each. Mix that in, add that to mustard oil, and saute the fish. You can add just regular old tomatoes and onions while you're sauteing it, and then it's a dry curry. Or you can add some water; it becomes, you know, more of a liquidy wet curry, which you can eat with white rice. It's again very simple, but there are many different ways to make fish. You can also steam this fish with mustard seeds and green chili, and mustard oil. Stick it in a steamer or a pressure cooker. Mm-hmm. You can do the same thing, cumin, coriander, turmeric, ginger, and then steam that with a little bit of coconut milk. That's more of a Kerala version, I would say. Mm-hmm. So there are many different ways you can make fish. I can continue on talking about the ways to. So as you can see, you know, my love affair is with fish. Now,
right.
You can have large or small sized fish. Sometimes you use whole fish. I like to use fillets. It just cooks better, quicker, mm-hmm. and the flavor stays. And you're really not. The good part about cooking fish is you're not cooking it for hours on end. It's right. usually a 10 to 15 minute process.
Exactly. And I made the mistake in scheduling this recording before dinner. So now you've made me hungry and I need to make these both naru and I need to make fish. These both sound amazing. I had to ask you about food, and thinking of it from the Kerala perspective, the food I always recommend if you've never eaten Kerala food is putta and kadala, probably my favorite breakfast of all time.
Appam,
so good. And then a nice bowl of payasam is a great dessert. Yeah. And same those coconut and cardamom flavors. I mean, we're all nuts about food. No matter what part of India you're from, you're probably nuts about food. So yes. That's something we all have in common.
I know. Payasam is called payesh in Bengali. And mm-hmm. we never had birthday cakes like every normal kid in Delhi did. Mm-hmm. We only had payasam, which is what you eat. You call it payasam, we call it payesh. And you had to sit on the ground and eat three scoops of it with your finger and mm-hmm. then touch your parents' feet. And then they would bless you with green grass stalks and rice husk. And that's more a concept of blessing your child with more prosperity. And so for mm-hmm. me, payasam has connotations of birthdays, which is weird, but that's what it is. And, you know, so I remember when we were growing up, it was just hard to not get a birthday cake because everybody else is getting a birthday cake. But my parents were like, nope, we're doing payesh.
I absolutely love that. So we could talk about food all day, but in the interest of time, I want to switch gears and talk about the book you picked for this episode, which unfortunately isn't quite as much of a laughing matter. This is a very serious book, but it's a very important book, and that is Azadi, a recent collection of essays by Arundhati Roy. For my longtime listeners, you might remember the episode I did with Mina Sechkin on The God of Small Things back in November. We basically spent 45 minutes gushing over it. It was my favorite book I had read that year. I am surprised that it was my first time reading it. And I just knew I would remember that book forever. And so I was so excited to dive into this one. I know that Roy she's only written two novels. She's mostly known for her essays, for her nonfiction, for her activism. And this book came out in about 2020. It includes some speeches and essays given in the past 4 years. And it focuses on the topics right on the cover, freedom, fascism, fiction. And it revolves around those. And before we dive into the book any further, Mother Shree, could you tell me a little bit about how you found this book and what your thoughts were on it?
So Azadi for me is just a continuation of anything Arundhati Roy writes. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, Arundhati can do no wrong. I love her writing style. I enjoy reading her work. But more importantly, I love that even when she comes up with problematic statements, how passionate she is about it. Mm-hmm. She will continue to do what she does because she's an activist at heart. She's always been that. And I just truly enjoy how she has evolved as an author and as an activist and continues to do so despite the numerous challenges that the current Modi government places on her. Yeah. It is hard to continue to do that in a country where you are the voice of reason and you are the voice of the people and you continue to get suppressed. So Azadi for me is what I needed right during the pandemic when everything fell apart, and her words gave me guidance.
Yeah, that's a wonderful point. I mean, everything I've read by her thus far has been amazing. I also have to thank you for not choosing My Seditious Heart for this, because that is 1,000 pages and I did not have time for that. But this book, is a very, you know, concise collection, and it's focused on the past few years, you know, the recent Modi government, you know, how we have seen, and if And if you're not Indian, if you don't know a lot about the Indian government, this may feel a little alienating to you, but think of it this way. This is a continuation and of the fascism, the move towards the right that we have seen all over the world. In the United States, there are references to Donald Trump. I mean, we've seen these leaders take steps in that direction towards right-wing populism. And this is just one manifestation of that. And so what I loved about this book, I mean, it's what I love about all of Roy's writing, and it's her prose. It's not as stylish as maybe her fiction. It's more direct, but there's still that insight, her wit, her intelligence. It just comes through. My favorite essays in the books are the ones that integrated her thoughts on writing along with her thoughts on current events. The very first essay was a real highlight. It's really focused on translation, the language of translation, and what it means to write in a language that is not, quote unquote, your own. And then you're unpacking the politics of what is your language? You know, what has colonialism foisted on you? Where have you lived? You know, and I just found that's just an amazing way to bring together so much that she's written. And just from a prose level, this was really, really engaging.
Yeah, I love the fact that she started with it, because everybody was waiting for the Ministry of Utmost Happiness for the longest mm-hmm. while. And the Ministry is really not a very easy book to read. Mm-hmm. It's not an easy, and yes, it's fiction, but it's not easy to read. And it had multiple layers. You were talking about My Braided Essays. I mean, think about this book, which had right. multiple layers, multiple characters weaving in and out, and also talking about things in different languages and different thought processes when you are using different languages. Mm-hmm. So I love that she started with fiction and she did the nonfiction analysis of her own work, which I think is yeah. fantastic, where she's able to take a step back and say, this is what I was trying to do. And she stands by it, which is another way, a reason why I think Roy is such an amazing writer, and you really can't pigeonhole her into fiction or nonfiction. I think for her nonfiction is more direct, and this is of course me just completely projecting here, but I feel like that's how her brain works, mm-hmm. Because I feel she is an activist, and so her passion comes out in her nonfiction directly, and you're yeah. able to absorb exactly what she's saying. Whereas fiction, she has the liberty, and she takes the liberty to be much more devious in how she presents ideas.
Yeah,
you know, The God of Small Things, for example, if you've read it once, then you've not read it, because you need to read it multiple times to find out so many layers of, right. of issues and questions that she continues to address. And Ministry of Utmost Happiness is pretty much an extension of that.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. I mean, she's able to add in those layers in her fiction. And one line she brings up in one of the speeches is that, you know, is fiction, I'm paraphrasing here, but is fiction any less real or true than nonfiction? Mm. And that line sat with me for so long because it really got me thinking, you know, there is what you're able to tell in fiction, you know, using literary devices, using characters and plot lines, and how you're able to hold the reader, that doesn't mean that the content is any less real. And your presentation just really shines through. I don't know. There was so much to think about there. Mm-hmm. I think that thought just kind of stuck in my mind for the rest of the day after I read that part. And I was like, that's just so beautifully put. So for everyone's like, why aren't you writing? We haven't gotten a book by you in so long. She's like, I've been writing. I've been here. I'm just doing what I want to do.
Exactly. And the question again, you know, when you're looking at her from an activism perspective, she's not writing to stay relevant. She never wrote to stay relevant. She never wrote to get the attention. She's always mm-hmm. been doing that. I mean, I don't know if you know, but she acted. She's an actor. She's a screenwriter. Mm-hmm. And one of her movies was in which Annie gives those ones. It's about this girl in architecture school, which is where she was. She was an architect. Mm-hmm. And this is all Delhi. It's my city. So we knew of her because she was so different. She was so different from when she was a young person. And yeah. so for me, I just find that to be her essence, her free-spiritedness, that she is very, very focused on what she believes and what is true to her and her beliefs. And she commits 100% into that, whether it's fiction or nonfiction. And right. I want to add to that in terms of, you know, language and how you think in a certain language and then have to translate it into a language of your colonizers. If you're looking at Jhumpa Lahiri's book, In Other Words, that actually mm-hmm. also touches upon pretty much this concept. And I think a lot of us non-native speakers struggle with that, because yeah. it's not that we don't think in English. It's not that we think in another language. It's that we think in multiple languages. And when we think in multiple languages, the way we interpret a certain thought or how we put it down in a certain language may be very different. And Lahiri talks about that in her book, about the fact that she decided to learn Italian in order to write in Italian, which is another step away from language that we are familiar with. So, you mm-hmm. know, for her, it was Bengali and it was English, but she decided to move into Italian. I know we're talking about another author, but I think.
No, you're exactly.
Most authors, I feel, are grappling with that and trying mm-hmm. to understand if what they're communicating is what they want to communicate. And that's a struggle. I think it's a struggle, which is a sweet one. Because this is what writing is all about. You're questioning yourself and what you want to say and what you want others to hear.
Right. And there's obviously the intersections here of racism and sexism to it as well, when you think about the criticisms that Roy, she even says it directly when people are like, you know, who's the last person to write a masterpiece in a language that wasn't theirs? And she just glibly answers Nabokov. And she's mm-hmm. exactly right. And who was mm-hmm. criticizing Nabokov for being a Russian national writing in English and writing beautifully in English? And right. But we see these criticisms about Roy, about Lahiri when she decided to delve into it. These writers are escaping the boxes that we have put them in as Indian women who can only write in their lane. And that is just the limits that Western society is putting on them many times.
Absolutely. And I think Roy certainly, you know, said it glibly, but said it right. When you talk about yes. Russian authors talking about this. So, but, you know, I'll go back to what you asked me right at the beginning about my book, that you could not pigeonhole this book into a food memoir mm-hmm. or a recipe book or a cookbook. And that's what it is, because I think when we started out, when I came to this country around 93, most Indian authors were women, and most Indian authors writing in English were writing about food, the exoticization of the Indian woman, the troubled Indian woman who was going to be rescued, and also mm-hmm. cooking with jasmine and wearing wearing jasmine, cooking with cumin and coriander. And I promised myself I wouldn't write that, because that's not the life I come from. and I end up right. writing about food. I end up writing about food. So who's laughing now? But at least I hope that we are talking about Indians not as these exotic creatures where the brown man is subservient mm-hmm. and the brown woman is exotic.
Right. That's a great way of wording it. There's a great book I read years ago. We're kind of going in different directions. I don't mind. There's a great mm-hmm. book. I can't remember the name of the book now, but the author is Naban Ratnam, and he talks about, you know, the curry book, quote unquote, where you've got the mangoes on the cover and the lotuses, and it's
yes.
sort of diving into sort of a Western gaze on India, and it's like, beware of these types of books. And mm-hmm. I started seeing them everywhere after reading this. And it's just, you see it everywhere. You know, we are sometimes, Indians are putting themselves in that category. And it's something we have to be mindful of. And I think this brings me back to a thought I was having while reading Azadi. And it was, you know, I'm reading about atrocities in Kashmir and the statelessness of people from Assam and mm-hmm. all of these things that I knew about vaguely, but didn't know the details. And mm-hmm. you're being inundated with these details. This is not an easy read. And the thing that kept occurring to me is, what role do I have as an Indian American? My parents were immigrants. I've been born and raised in America, but I claim Indian heritage. What claim do I have to that heritage when I don't know? And I don't have an answer to that question, but I also want to bring in that at the same time that I was reading this book, I was also reading for another episode of this show. I was reading the actor Cal Penn's latest book, his memoir. And I enjoyed that book for what it was. I thought it was very earnest, very warm, very funny. But I was reading that at the same time. And having both of these together, it had me think that Cal Penn's sort of take on his Indian heritage was very familiar to me. You know, there's this element of we worship Gandhi and the independence struggle. And, you know, now this is where we are. And there's this nostalgia and rose-colored glasses when we think about India. But we're not really engaging in what India is now. We're not engaging in the criticisms of that time. The Roy herself criticizes Gandhi quite openly. Correct. And that's something a lot of Indians are uncomfortable with just on concept. And I don't know, I wish I had like a salient point at the end of this, but this just brought up a lot of thoughts about, you know, what claim do we have to our heritage when we're not critically thinking about it the way we should be?
Yeah, so I think that's a valid point because, you know, there is a combination of immigrants like me and second generation folks like you here, and all of us claim to be Indian and American, right? But, you know, I lived there, but now I've lived here longer than there. So what claim do I have to criticize a government that is not mine anymore, right? But I feel as global citizens, which is what we are, given that our genetic material comes from there, we do have a claim. We do have a claim and we do have a right to love the country that we come from. And if we are loving that country that we come from, we also have the right to raise our voices when injustice is happening. The Kashmir situation has been escalating and has been horrifying for decades on end. It's been going on since India got independence. So this is nothing new, but the systematic way that the state has been shut down, children get picked on the street for interrogation. Young men get brutalized. Roy has talked about it. I've talked about it. I think a lot. If you look at Suchitra Vijayan and her work in the Polis Project and her book Midnight's Borders, they talk about it ad nauseum. I think my generation, the generation after me, are actively talking about it. Whether we come from India or we are second generation, I think it's immaterial if there is some genetic material that comes from there. That's how I feel. I also feel there are so many parallels. There are so many parallels to what's happening in India, to what's happening in America. And it breaks my heart every time I see that. You know, you can always go back and say, well, you know, chalta hai, ab hum kya kare, which means, you know, it is what it is. What should I do? And the fact is, if you don't do anything, then you are also part of the problem. You are also part of the problem. So if you can use words, use words. If you can use a podcast, use a podcast. If you believe that what is being said by the Modi government is accurate and true, then talk about it. I am happy to have a discourse on somebody who disagrees with me. And you know, if we go about and say, well, all of Indian youth believes in the current government in India, that's great, but I don't think that's true. So when we had the Delta variant course through India last year around April, the kind of comments that would come up, the kind of discourse that would happen about the government not doing anything about it, You can't hide that. Social media is a very powerful tool, and we need to use that if we believe what we're doing is the right thing to do.
Yeah, you're so right. I think the pandemic brought a lot of things into focus. I mean, the increasing publicity of the recent government, you know, you're seeing this even more broadly. I think your note on, you know, we can love the country of origin that we have, and we should, and we can also criticize it, and we should. I think that's the message that we need to take with us. You know, it's not that we don't have a right to anything, to claim a country or anything like that, but claiming a heritage should come with an awareness that, you know, things aren't all rosy in the motherland, even though you may want to think they are. Or, you know, you are not absolved of privilege, even though there's a white majority in the United States. You know, there are layers to these things that need to be unpacked. And I think this book, you know, reading as many of these narratives as I can read, or just putting it all in perspective for me personally, I think if I was to levy any criticisms of Azadi as a book, it mm-hmm. mostly comes down to composition. And mm-hmm. it's the essays themselves are repetitive. You know, they're a combination of speeches, and these places, these speeches and essays, you know, had homes in other areas, and then they were brought together. And so by nature, you're going to see themes and ideas repeated quite a bit in similar ways. And in that respect, you wonder, you know, what were the choices involved in bringing these particular pieces together? You can get a bit bogged down in the details. But honestly, I think the content and the style of writing still elevates this book above some of those repetitions.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think if you've read her other essay collections on, you know, when she's talked about the Narmada Dam, mm-hmm. Ambedkar, there are many other essays that she has. There is a tendency of repetition, but mm-hmm. But I feel if that is the focus of these essays, where she's trying to drive home the point of what is important to her at that particular moment, I think it's very successful. You don't have to read all the essays to get the content, you know, but right. I really liked the last one, which is The Pandemic is a Portal, because yeah. that really gave us a view. And this was before the Delta variant course through India. Mm-hmm. And it basically talked about class differences between the Indians who could stay at home, who could continue to not go out and reduce and flatten the curve. Remember when we used to talk mm-hmm. about flattening the curve, which was a joke?
2 weeks.
A fucking joke. Anyway, but you know, but there were laborers, day laborers who had to walk back home because everything was shut down. So they didn't know mm-hmm. how they could go home. And all that community, that is an invisible class within India, where they come from different villages and small towns that are on the other part of the country, and they come to the metropolitan city. So they had to walk back home hundreds of miles mm-hmm. Just by themselves. And I think it's not only is it a human rights issue, not only is it a social justice issue, it is just what we did was horrible. To mm-hmm. people like that, we just we killed people like that. The pandemic didn't, we did. So you know, us sitting here and you know, yelling and screaming at Twitter is great, but what have we really done? And I struggled with that myself, as in, you know, it's very easy for me to go and tweet something and say, look at me, I'm so awesome, but what am I really doing? And so I feel the only thing I can do is use my words, whether I'm writing or I'm talking. That's all I can do, is say what I did, what I didn't do affected people in a country that is still mine.
You say that we see the same in the US. I mean, the pandemic uncovered even more inequities that were present in society. There was a case in India, it was a case in the United States, a case all over the world. You know, the most vulnerable are still those who are underprivileged, the poor, the disenfranchised. I mean, this essay shed a light on that in a different cultural context, but it's very much the same that we see over here.
Yeah.
And to sort of transition to other books that I would bring into conversation with this one, I mean, obviously you can read all of Roy's work. Everything I've read by her has been excellent. I have a copy of The Ministry of Utmost Happiness on my desk that I actually got signed by her. I've mentioned this on other shows. She came to the United States and read at the Brooklyn Public Library, and I have a signed copy that I haven't read yet.
Hmm.
But I need to read it.
Yeah, I mean, give yourself some time and be kind to yourself if you have to put it down and start over.
Yeah, I think that's fair. But the book that I was thinking about, and it's a book that, albeit I have not finished yet, but I've kind of picked up and put down over a long period of time, is actually the book Cast by Isabel Wilkerson.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a book I've brought up before on the show. And basically, Isabel Wilkerson posits that the racial structure in America is akin to a caste system. And she brings in, you know, the situation here in the United States with anti-blackness. She brings in Nazi-era Germany, and she brings up the caste system in India. And she compares and contrasts and brings together a narrative. And there are flaws to the narrative, sure, but I thought it was a really interesting way to bring these together. And Roy herself is often bringing Nazi Germany into conversation when she's talking about the rise of fascism in India. So these are things that relate to one another, especially these days. It's even more timely, I feel, right now. So that's a book that I thought of in relation to all this. Mother Shree, do you have a book that you'd bring into conversation?
What I would bring it, I really like caste, so I think you're talking about it in the right sense of the word. What I would bring in, especially for people who want to learn more about South Asians born and brought up here in this country, is my dear friend Anjali Njeri's book, Southbound. Identity, Inheritance. And the reason why I say that is because Anjali grew up in the South. So there is the South, there is the blackness, there is the brownness. And how do you navigate that in terms of your identity as a mixed race child? And then what happens when you grow up and become an activist, and what does activism really mean to you? Anjali has been the founding member for Desi Blue, the South Asian group that helped turn Georgia blue. And she has been a role model for me in how to be an activist, how to campaign, and how to phone bank. And these are things that are grassroots level campaigning, grassroots level activism, but it actually talks about, do you really love this country? And if you love this country, how far will you go out of your comfort zone in order to make sure that your voice is heard?
Yeah. Right?
And so it's a dense collection of multiple essays on identity, on inheritance, what you inherit. And I recommend that. It's also from a small press. And so I recommend that to anybody who would like to understand where we brown people came from and where we brown people are going.
I love that suggestion. I've read Anjali Njeti's novel, The Parted Earth, which I really enjoyed. But I've been meaning to pick up that collection of essays. And as a person who also grew up in the South, I'm originally from Florida, I feel like there's something in there I need to access. And so definitely going to pick that up.
That's awesome.
And so, Mother Shree, before we close out, can you tell us where we can find you and where we can find your work?
You can find me online, and I shouldn't be on it. So if you find me online, tell me to get back to work, please. I think a lot of my online friendships are so intense and so fun. I am the perfect example of a Desi auntie who loves chatting with anybody who will chat with me. I'm on social media at Write Madhu Shree, so WRITE. Madhu Shree, MADHUSHREE. Come say hi. There's my website. You can find me on the University of Iowa Press catalog. Do you need my phone number too?
We don't want them spamming you, but that's a great place to start. And you all definitely should pick up Madhu Shree's book. We'll have links to it in the show notes. Seriously, this is a book I don't want you all to miss. It's not that long either. If you're really intimidated by long books, this book is perfect for you. It's just a beautiful length. There's so much diversity in the storytelling that you're bringing, the narratives. There's something in it for everyone. And so you definitely want to pick up Kabar as well.
Thank you so much. This has just been such a spectacularly delicious conversation.
And thanks all of you for listening. So as a reminder, we have episodes every Thursday of Your Favorite Book. 3 weeks a month, we have our interview episodes with writers and readers. And then the last week of every month, we have our short story book club. And this month, announcing the one for April, we're taking things in a slightly different direction. And we're talking about an essay this month. Yes, it still counts. It's a short piece of writing and you can access it online, so no excuses not to join the club. Our guest is Jasmine Vias, who you might remember from our episode on What We Carry by Maya Lang. The essay we are talking about is called The Worst Friend Date I Ever Had by Samantha Irby. And if you've read any Samantha Irby before, you know this is going to be absolutely hilarious. And I think we're going to have quite a bit to talk about related to this essay. And I don't want to spoil it any further for everybody. If you want to read along with us, there is a link to the essay in the show notes. You definitely want to do that because there are spoilers in the monthly short story essay episodes. And if you'd like to follow the podcast, follow us on Instagram and Twitter at YFB Podcast. If you want to rate and review, please do so. Apple, Google, Spotify, no matter where you listen, there's usually a way to give us 5 stars, and it's much appreciated. Till then, everybody, happy reading, and I'll see you next week.